to Holly and to Leib for hosting tonight. It's Hoshana Rabbi, is as Rabbi Zinitsky said, it's really the end, the continuum of how things go. During the month of Elul, up until Rosh Hashanah, we say Ksiva Ksima Teva, everyone should be written for good. After Rosh Hashanah, until Yom Kippur, it's Chasimu, Gemar Ksima Teva, it's already been sealed for good. And then many have the custom during these days say piskatava, which means you should have a good kvittel. It means it should be delivered well. Because you have the contract that's written, then it's signed and sealed, but then it has to be delivered. So the delivery of the judgment happens Hoshana Rabbah, as the Zohar says. So it's a suspicious time for us to be learning. The first couple sources here I'll just kind of paraphrase just to give us a little bit of background about what Hoshana Rabbah was like in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, the Arava, the willow that Holly spoke about before, played a very prominent role on Sukkot. They would find these very tall, 18-foot Aravas. They'd put them next to the Mizbech, next to the altar in the Beis HaMikdash. They would kind of go over the top and decorate the whole Mizbech during the week of Sukkot. They would make a parade around the Mizbech every day of Sukkot. And on Hoshana Rabbah, they would parade seven times. That's what they said, the seven hakafas they would have. If the Mishnah tells us if it fell out on Shabbos of Chol HaMoed, they would not do the parading with the Luv and Esrig. They would not put the willows. They would not arrange the willows next to the Mizbeach, except it was Hoshana Rabbah. If Hoshana came out on Shabbos, they would not forfeit the celebration with the Arava branches. They would do that even on Shabbos in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. After the Churban, after the destruction of the temple, the sages and the prophets instituted various customs and traditions that are Zechel Mikdash, that reminded us of the Avoda, reminded us of the service in the temple itself. So, for example, we shake Lulav and Esrig now, except for the first day, for the subsequent days. It's also Zechel Mikdash. It reminds us of what the behavior was in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. Roshan the Rabbah, we still parade around the Bima once a day during davening, or Shana Rabbah, we do it seven times itself. Those are all things that we have. But the Rabbah itself is not something which is explicitly stated in the Torah itself. And as a result, after the destruction of the temple, it didn't have any real longevity to it, except for Hoshana Rabbah, which we're going to talk about tonight. Now, there's one element of Hoshana Rabbah, which is a little bit less known, which is quite interesting, and that is that Hoshana Rabbah is set up in such a way never to fall out on Shabbos. Hoshana Rabbah never falls out on Shabbos. So look at text number 4, skipping out a little bit over here, that this is from a Tosfos, a commentary of the Balei Tosfos in Gemara Sukkah, and says the following. He tells us, in text number 4, says Shema Arabin Elul, if they saw that Hoshana Rabbah was going to land out on Shabbos, in the times when the Sanhedrin would establish the calendar, they would add a day to Elul, make it 29 days, take a day away, or add a day, make it 30 days, just to make sure that Hoshana Rabbah would never fall out on Shabbos. Or if they saw more in advance, one of the other months they would see, they would add a month if that was necessary, all to make sure that Shvi Shel Arava, as the Tosfos refers to it, the seventh day of the Arava, would not fall out on Shabbos. And then Tosfos quotes a Gemara Yerushalmi, also Gemara Sukkah, says Rabbi Simon Mefaked, Rabbi Simon would tell those who were in charge of doing the calculations for the calendar, he would say, I want you to know that set it up in such a way that the Rosh Hashanah should not fall out on Shabbos, because if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, don't blow the shofar. That's one thing to make sure of, and also that the Arava should not fall out on Shabbos, and Hoshana Rabbah should not fall out on Shabbos either. Two things, they should make the calculation as such. And if it's difficult to do that, then it's okay if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, but it's never okay if Hoshana Rabbah falls out on Shabbos. Which Tosfos says an extremely, extremely puzzling question. And that is, when it comes to the blowing of the shofar, and the shaking the lulav and the esrog, that is a mitzvah d'oraisa. That's a mitzvah explicitly from the Torah. The Torah tells us, blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. The Torah tells us, take the lulav and the esrog and shake it on Sukkot. If it falls out on Shabbos, you forfeit the mitzvah of shofar, and you forfeit the mitzvah of lulav and esrog. However, when it comes to Hoshanas, when it comes to the willows, which are not deraisa, they are only a zecher lamikdash, that we're worried that it should not fall out on Shabbos. So it's very, very intriguing. Here you have a mitzvah, a custom, a mitzvah nevim, minig nevim, a custom of the nevim, of the prophets, to do this ceremony with the willow branches. There's no source in Torah itself, and yet Shabbos should never fall on Shabbos, so we'll always be able to observe it. Shofar and lulav, we're able to let go. How come? So Tosfos gives a practical answer. He says, because these are discussed in the Torah itself, you'll never forget about them. No one's ever going to doubt, you don't blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah. You don't shake lulav and esrog on Sukkos. It's written in the Torah itself. But because Aravah, the willow, the ceremony with the willow branches are not mentioned in the Torah itself, if you skip 1 year, people may have doubt the following year. Are you really going to do it or not? Is this really something we're supposed to be doing? So he gives a novel answer and says, because we want to make sure that people don't forget, that there may be raised some doubt into the nature of the obligation of the Aravah, we don't do it. Well, fine. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe analyzed this in a talk on Hoshana Rabbah in the 1983, and he said there's something special about this Aravah. The fact that it's not able to fall out on Shabbos tells us there's something that requires a little bit of deeper explanation, understanding to the unique nature of the mitzvah itself. And he says there's two ways of looking at this willow, these willows that were brought in the temple and leaned up against the Mizbeach. The question, you could look at it as, you could say, the idea of the willow in the Beis HaMikdash, it is an outgrowth of a different willow branch that we use on Sukkos, which is the willow in our lulav and esrog, our floral, or expensive botanical floral arrangement that we all spend a lot of money on for the holiday of Sukkos. So one outlook could be, is that the willow, the arava that's placed on the Mizbech, on the temple, is an outgrowth of the willow that's found in the lulav and the esrog, which means that it's an obligation upon the person to do another action with a willow branch. So that the mitzvah of a rava, the mitzvah to do something with a willow branch, grows out of the mitzvah of lulav and esrog. It's an obligation upon the person, on the gavra. That's a chavis gavra. It's an obligation on the person. A little brisk language.
Brisk of words.
It's a chavis gavra. It's an obligation on the person to do another action with this willow branch. One action is sticking your lulav and esrog arrangement. The second is make sure they have a willow branch to put next to the mizbeach. Because the chavis gavra is an obligation on the person itself. That's one approach. Another approach that Rebbe says of thinking about this mitzvah, it's not another action, another willow branch action that's an obligation upon the person, but it's a different mitzvah altogether. It's a different chefza. It's a chefza shel mitzvah. It's a different object, a different idea of obligation altogether. It's not what that person has to do one more thing, but the second arava, the second willow, is in a different category of mitzvah than the willow branch that's in your lulav and the esrog. Two approaches. Either the willow against the altar is an outgrowth of the willow in your lulav and esrog. It's an obligation on the person. Or it is a separate mitzvah in and of itself, standalone, unique, a separate mitzvah identity. Now, in true brisker form, in order to make a chiluk of chefs and gavra, to make a distinction between an obligation on a person as opposed to the obligation of the object or the act separate from the person itself, you can only make such a distinction if there's a nafka mina la'alacha. You can only make that distinction if there's some practical distinction, some practical difference in Jewish law itself. So what difference does it make whether the willow branch in the temple grows out of the mitzvah of your lulav and esrog, or whether it grows out of its own unique mitzvah or not? So the Rebbe says, look at text number 5. The distinction actually is a big disagreement, is a disagreement in the Gemara about what is the halachic measure and definition of this willow branch that you put against the Mizbeach. Now, ideally, you find a 15, 20-foot branch that's going to lean up against the altar, and it's going to hang over the top and decorate it from on top. But there is a certain minimum requirement that you have to have. So in the Gemara Sukkah has this debate. The debate is between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes. So the question is, how much is the measure, the halachic measurement of this willow branch? Rav Nachman, Gimel Badi Alin Lachi. So Rav Nachman says it has to be at least 3 branches with three moist leaves on it. Three moist leaves. Rav Sheshet says no. Even if you have Allah Echad or Bat Echad, even if you have one leaf and one stick, that's enough. So what does that have to do with anything over here? So the idea of three moist leaves, if you want to understand, you're looking at your lulav and esrog, and you want to know, is my arava, my willow branch in my arrangement, is it kosher or not kosher? So the Rambam says it has to have three lush leaves. If it has three moist leaves, you're good. Less than that, it's out. So when Rav Nachman says you need the willow branch of the altar needs three lush leaves, that's very reminiscent of the willow branch that connects to your lulav and your esrog. And Rav Sheshe says no. He says even one stick and one leaf, one branch and one leaf is enough. That means it has nothing to do with your lulav and esrog. So Rav Nachman takes the approach that it's a chavas gavra, it's another action that the person has to do with a willow branch. And Rav Sheshe says, no, it's a separate, unique, standalone mitzvah, one branch and one leaf, that's all you need. How are we doing so far? No one fell asleep yet? Okay, good. Right. On Shabbos, you should be for sleeping by this point. Anyway, so text number six, the Rambam, in commenting on all of this, makes some very interesting statements in this halacha. This is the 20th paragraph, the 7th chapter, in the laws of Lulav. And the Rambam first says, Halacha l'meisha misinai, which we're going to get to and file that concept away, that the idea of the willow branch is something which was conveyed to us by Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. Shemavim b'mikdash arava acheres, you bring another willow branch. I mean another in distinction to the willow branch of your lulav. So if you have a really mega, gigantic, long lulav, with a 15-foot arava in your lulav, and you take that willow branch and put it against the mizbeah, against the altar, the Rambam paskens like Rav Sheshe and says, no, it can't grow out of yours, and that's nothing to do with the mitzvah of lulav and esrog. The lulav, it's a separate standalone thing altogether. So it has to be an additional arava, an additional willow branch, other than the willow branch of your lulav. He says further, in fact, you don't discharge your obligation if you use the willow that's connected to your lulav. So he's a very strong statement. It's really in a category all of its own. This willow branch does not connect to the lulav in any way, shape, or form. And then he quotes Rav Sheshe, and what is the minimum size of it? One branch with one leaf. One branch, one leaf. Now, this comment of Rambam, so we see, it was partially based on text number 5, but the measure of it. But the very beginning three words, that the arava, the willow branch of the Beis HaMikdash, is halachal. What time did I start?
You got the recorder. 13 minutes in.
Okay, good. So, that where did it... Okay, I'm going to pace myself over here.
You're really 20 minutes in by 13.
Okay, sorry.
Just
so the... So the idea of halacha l'Moshe misinai, it's directly given down from Moshe at Har Sinai. This is also another debate in the Gemara, another debate in the Talmud itself. And that's a debate between Avashol. And there it says, Avashol is of the opinion, text number 7, that there's a debate, what's the source of this willow in the temple? This is building somewhere, by the way. It's building somewhere. So Avashol says, when the Torah commands us to take the four different species, the lulav and esrog, he says, arvei nachal, which willows of the brook. Willows, one willow for the lulav and esrog, one willow for the mizbeah. Again, growing out of the same concept, growing out of the same idea, where the lulav is related to the willow on the temple altar. The Rabbanans say, no, halacha l'meisha misinai, it's in a different category altogether. So, in summary of the nigla, the Talmudic parts of this conversation, we have four main points that we've been able to establish. Number one is that the arava of the mizbeach, the willow that leaned against the altar, which, by the way, Hoshana Rabbah comes to commemorate, it is halachically separate from the willow branch of your lulav. That's point number one. Point number two is its measure is unique. One branch, one leaf. Number three, Hoshana Rabbah can never fall out on Shabbos, and the calendar was manipulated to make sure it would never fall out on Shabbos. And a fourth point is the source and the whose authority do we observe this, the mitzvah of Arava, it's Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, as the oral tradition handed down from Hashem to Moshe at Har Sinai. Four points that we've been able to establish here. Okay, that's all the revealed parts of Torah. How is this viewed through the lens of Chassidus? In the lens of Chassidus, you have text number 8, where the previous Rebbe said the following. The previous Rebbe says, Arava, what is the Arava? And Hali alluded to this before. Hey, manoshim shutim, they are simple people. The Arava are the simple Jews, where the fulfillment of their mitzvahs is be'emunah pshuta, which means the fulfillment of their mitzvahs is with pure, simple faith. Nothing complicated, no deep reasons, no deep philosophy. They're simply doing mitzvahs because God said to do mitzvahs. They're simple, simple Jews. And then he asked, they call Yisrael, Hem shavim be'inyan kima terva mitzvahs. When it comes to fulfillment and observance of Torah mitzvahs, all Jews are equal. How is this important? Text number 9 is a very famous medrash, which Holly quoted before, which is looking at each of the Dalet Minim, each of the four species. Say, the Esrim has a tam v'reach, has taste and smell. Taste refers to intellect. Smell reflects the emotional connection to doing mitzvahs. So you have the Esrog, which has the smell and taste. They have intellect and the doing of the mitzvahs. You have the Hadas, the myrtle branch, which has smell but no taste. That's the idea of those who are involved with doing of mitzvahs, but not necessarily learned and not intellectually developed. Then you have the lulav, which has taste, the date palm, involved with learning of Torah, where it has no smell, there's not necessarily a focus on doing mitzvahs. Then you have the arava, which has no tam, no reach. It has no smell, no taste, no Torah, no masim tevim. But the last line of the midrash sometimes gets forgotten. It's a very important line. That's text number 9, the last sentence. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yukshru kulam aguda achas v'hem mechaprim elu al elu. Tie, bind all of them together, and they will atone one for the other. Now, on a very basic level, we're talking about four different levels of various levels of Torah knowledge and how much observance they have. Some have more Torah, less observance, more observance, less Torah. Some have a balance of both, and some have neither. That's the simple understanding of the Mishnah itself. Chassidus goes a little bit deeper and says they're talking about four different experiences of Torah mitzvahs. Four different ways people experience Torah mitzvahs. The Esrog is an individual who experiences Torah mitzvahs with a deep intellectual appreciation for Torah, and also a deep emotional capacity to have love and awe in their doing of the mitzvahs. They have a deep capacity of smell, deep capacity of taste, deep intellect, deep emotions. Their experience of Torah mitzvahs is complete. Then you have the lulav. The lulav is the person who masters Torah, but their mitzvahs are kind of dry. You know, dry, technical, robotic. That's the lulav Jew. You have the hadas Jew, where that person is fervently active in mitzvahs, but quite unlearned. Then you have the arava, which the previous Rebbe says has simple faith, a simple, absolute commitment. Not blessed with deep understanding, not blessed with the sophistication of feeling, and that enriches Torah mitzvahs that the other three have, just plain and simple. Now, the last sentence is, each one comes to atone for the other. So you think, which one's the big atoner over here? The Esrog should atone for everybody. But it says, each one, all of them atone for each other. Each of them gives something to the other three that they don't have. The Esrog gives to all the other three blend, balance, sophistication, harmony of thought and deed, harmony of mind and heart. Lulav contributes to the other three, steiging in Torah, utter devotion to Torah study. The Hadas contributes deep emotion, service of the heart, avodah shebelev, davening, good deeds, masim tevim. What does the Arava contribute? Simplicity. The Arava contributes simplicity. Now, when we say simple, you're a very simple person. That's usually not a compliment. Usually means you're very low intelligence. But simple also means not a composite. It's not compound. It's composed of one singular element. The Arava contributes simplicity. This is and simplicity in the eyes of Chassidus is a clear and perfect window into divine essence. Text number 12 and 13, we can skip over a little bit. Actually, look at number 11. Text number 11 is important. In this discussion, the Rebbe brought Ki Yedua, the revolt from Baal Shem Tov. It's known the phrase, the saying from the Baal Shem Tov, the Pshitus from the Nashim Pshutim, the simplicity of a simple Jew is Ein Zach mit Pshitus, is one thing with the utter simplicity of the essence of God. The simplicity of a Jew is a window into the simplicity of God. And when you say God is being simple, means Achdus Pshuta, the absolute oneness and unity of godliness, where it's not that God is one as opposed to 2, 3, 4, 5, but God is completely at one with everything. That's it. Text 12 and 13 from the Rambam and from the Sefer Ikrim developed the idea of oneness, simplicity, purity. So the virtues of the other, so let's go back to our four groupings together, our willows together. This is okay, this is really fast. Your watch is very fast, Rabbi Sinetsky. To go to be quick. So we have two aravas.
You know, when Rav Salvichik used to give shiur, he would go 4 hours. The problem was they only had 2 hours for the guys who were taking undergraduate classes. Okay. So they used to set the clock 2 hours back.
Okay.
It's the same.
I should have tried that ahead of time.
Tom is part of the Brisker Board.
I should have held it. All right, good, good. So let's go quick over here. So the simplicity is a window into divine essence. What's the opposite of simplicity? Complexity. So the more complex one is, the more sophisticated one is, the less simple you are. So that sophistication and complexity clouds that window of simplicity. So you have the feelings of the... So in the same way that the Arava impacts the other three, that giving them emunah pshuta, giving a simple, pure faith in God, the other three impact the Arava also. So all of the understanding of the lulav and the feeling of the hadas and the perfection of the esrin, that also spells their deficiency. Their complexity spells their deficiency. And it influences the arava that's in the lulav. So the simplicity of the arava, the simplicity of the willow branch in the lulav is a relative simplicity. Relative to the other three, it's simple. But by itself, it's not. So, the Arava is a stand, the Arava of the Beis HaMikdash, the Arava of Hoshana Rabbah, is a standalone mitzvah, which maintains its purity, and it has one leaf and one branch, which is not caught up in numberedness. That's not a word. It's not caught up in numberedness. It's pure. One number, one branch, one leaf. So the Arava, the willow in the Lulav and Esrog, is enriched by them. That enrichment minimizes its simplicity. So therefore the Torah says we have to have another Arava, another willow branch, which by the way can't fall out on Shabbos, because you can't forfeit that kind of simplicity. The simple, absolute commitment to God can never be forfeited. No matter what the vicissitudes of time and Shabbos, even Shabbos can't interfere with it. It's an absolute, it's absolute pnimius, it's absolute innerness. That's what's halacha l'moshe misinai. It's so pure, it can't be commanded. They talk about three guys sitting in a coffee shop, telling how much, you know, they love their wife. And one guy says, Beryl says, you know, when my wife tells me to take out the garbage, you know what I do? I take out the garbage. So, well, you love your wife, that's amazing. So the other guy says, yeah, but I love my wife even more. When she says, boy, it smells in here, I know right away to take out the garbage. Third guy says, I can even top that. I wake up in the morning, I know my wife wants to take out the garbage. I don't have to be told, I don't have to be hinted to it, it's absolute. I know exactly what she wants. I know exactly what she needs. Some mitzvahs we have are told to us in the Torah. Mitzvahs deraisa, biblical mitzvahs. They're told, go do this. There's some mitzvahs that are hinted, the Rabban, the Chachamim, the Sages instituted, the Navim instituted it. Those are things, okay, it's told us that it smells in here, I better do something about it. Then the highest form of devotion are minhagim. Minag Yisrael Teirahi. Why? Minag Yisrael, why Minag? Why the Teirah? Because the highest level of simplicity, the highest level of connection to the Eivish, to the Hashem, is in Minhagim. That comes from a deep, visceral place within the soul of each and every Jew. So, back to our questions, and I'll get out of here. So, we have the Rav is a standalone mitzvah, because that simplicity cannot be enriched compromised, even in a good way. It's one branch and one leaf to show the idea of the oneness and the uniqueness and the bond of the Hashem. Hoshana Rabbah can never fall out on Shabbos because that simplicity can never be forfeited. And lastly, it's Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. God gave it to us from Moshe and Masai and could not write it in the book. Once it's written, it's already compromised. Because from the deepest place we have. So L'Chaim, this Hoshana Rabbah, Hashem should help each and every one of us overcome our sophistication and come in touch with some of our simple. We have time now to tell the story about the simple Jew. We'll tell that story a little bit later. I already cut into everybody's time, I'm sorry. But that we should all be blessed with the ability to have our simplicity enrich all the other parts of our life. So, l'chaim.
Shkoyach. Very, very nice. Beautiful. All right. Hey, so I'm going to pass around complimentary sheets. I'm going to stand up for the lulav. Does he say explicitly that the lulav is the brisker, or he doesn't actually
say it?
Okay. Very, very beautiful. Jump in, go ahead.
It just reminds me how different these two worlds are. What you just said reminds me of how different academic world, at least in the field of English literature, and our world is. I was at a lecture a long time ago, and the speaker got up, and she mentioned that the goal in her analysis was to problematize the text. And I said to myself, what is wrong with this picture? Most people want to get rid of problems. And I know what she meant, but it is just so indicative of how we can get carried away with an idol of complexity and sophistication.
But there's a place for it. There is an Esrog, there is a Hadas, there is an Arav, there is a Lulav.
I just remember that word just struck me as what?
Interesting. Very great. That's good. I have a question for you, actually, picking back on that, and maybe others have heard of this as well. I remember one time coming home from school and sharing the following Dvar Torah. Our teacher, this must have been maybe fourth, fifth grade, or something around thereabouts, and you know, you come home with like the pre-Pesach folder, you know, the Haggadah, you know, like, and you have to impress the world with all of your Dvar Torah at every single part of the Seder, and you know, it goes that way. Anyhow, so the Dvar Torah that I brought home was as follows. It said, every one thinks that which is the greatest of the four sons, right, is the Chacham.
Right,
and I came home and I said, I learned in school, they taught me that the highest one is actually the Tan. Right? And my parents looked at me like I fell off the face of either the moon or Mars. They said, that's not what I learned, that's not what I heard. But it occurs to me that I wonder if...
it's a Hasidic teaching that what? Shaino Yodel Yushol is the highest.
Is even similar.
Exactly what you were when you said right. That. It
it's built. It's
it's the progression. It turns it on its head. The Chacham is actually so caught up in the complexity that it isn't able to see the oneness and.
But you can't be a Tam without the Chacham.
There we go.
There's a certain dimension. Ideally, there are people that are simple. They're simple, and they have a Mila. When the Friedrich Rebbe says, "Anoshim Pshutim," simple Jews. There are certain simple Jews. They have no option. And there's a purity to their conduct, a purity to their Torah mitzvahs. That's true. But if we have the luxury of being able to sit back, our goal is: how do you synthesize all of that? How do you synthesize the Chacham, the wisdom, and the complexity, and the Tam Vareach together with the Arava? And so Hashem the Rabbah is the reminder. We do have it set aside, and that's a constant reminder to us how that enriches the other parts and also vice versa.
Huh. Very nice. Very beautiful. Okay, fantastic. So I think hopefully over the course of my mini shiur, do I also get the extra time, Rabbi Sherman, or do I get less time?
How does it work? I'm here for the night.
All right.
I have something
just
to
one
say.
Point.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Most people, I think, would agree that the smartest people out there are the ones who can simplify.
What?
The smartest people out there are the ones that can simplify.
Usually, if I'm listening to somebody, I have no idea what they're talking about. It's probably because they don't have any idea what they're talking about.
Well said. Well said. Well said.
Very nice. Beautiful. Okay. Outstanding. So just to, just before coming to my piece, I wanted to also piggyback on that, because this this notion of simplicity also leads me to recall something that I heard from someone by the name of Rabbi Yosef Adler. Rabbi Yosef Adler, if anyone's familiar with the name, is a rabbi in Teaneck, New Jersey. He's had a shul, Rinat Yisrael, if anyone's heard of it. Rinat, he's been the rabbi there for a number of decades. He was also my high school principal in Torah Academy of Bergen County, TAVC. Great memories. I didn't get in trouble too often, so that was good. He's a very special person. And Rabbi Adler was a very close student of Rav Soloveitchik, and he was a shir for a number of years, and he was also a personal assistant. And you say the following about Rav Soloveitchik's shiurim, his Gemara shiurim, the advanced shiur that I mentioned earlier at Yeshiva University that went on for 4 hours. And he said as follows. He said, you know, when you walked out of Rav Soloveitchik's shiurim out of the Rav's classes, you said to yourself, that was so obvious. Which is not something you'd expect to say after hearing a shir from a great gaon, from an outstanding genius. And he used to say, but then people came to realize that was the genius of the Rav. Something you never would have possibly thought of beforehand was not now incredibly complex, since now it was crystal clear, it was pure simplicity, and that was part of the genius of the Rav. And that's sort of a fusion of sort of the intellectual piece and the simplicity piece that just resonated with me. So. Good. So before I jump into the official Torah, I wanted to take this opportunity to be Makir Tov, actually on a personal level, to express some Hakaras HaTov in many, many ways. I don't know if anyone in this room has heard this from me before, so this is a perfect opportunity for me to share just a little bit. It is extraordinarily unlikely, if not well-nigh impossible, that I would be sitting here and be immersed in Torah texts and the beauty and the profundity of Torah, if not, quite frankly, for Chabad. I'm going to explain why that is. It's absolutely true. My maternal grandfather, my mother's father, and along with his mother as well, but he was really the one who spearheaded it, did not grow up observant. I grew up in Oak Park, Michigan. Initially they were in Toronto, and then they came down across the border to Oak Park. Anyone been thereabouts? Is that a familiar area? Oak Park, there's a longstanding, I think, more modern Orthodox community there in Springfield as well, nearby. There's a conservative synagogue where my grandparents at the time were nominally members, but they weren't really actively involved in the synagogue, and there was an active Chabad, and it was actually through Chabad that my grandparents became observant, came to Yiddishkeit. It was actually the family of, perhaps some have heard of, Avram Fried. Is that a familiar name to a couple of people here? So Avram Fried, that I learned from my mother, who grew up with Avram Fried, was actually Friedman. Fried is a stage name. It's easier to say. It rolls off the tongue, apparently, better than Friedman. So I don't think there are any Fried. Anyhow, so he dropped the syllable. Exactly. They're in Israel, right?
Yeah,
they're in Israel.
Right.
Okay, good. All right. We'll have the recording. It was through his family and others in Oak Park, Michigan, that actually my grandparents came closer to Judaism. Ultimately, they joined the Chabad Shul, and that was how they became observant. My grandfather was actually extremely involved in Chabad. He did a number of things. He was in charge of the mikvah. He would get up at like 4:30 a.m. every single morning, because he and only he had the keys to the mikvah. True. They wouldn't let him share with anyone else. He's the only person they were willing to rely upon. And if he wasn't there, if Yisrael Lehman wasn't there, then there's no one to open up the mikvah. He also was involved in pilos. He used to go around and he would put on tefillin in patients in the hospital. Now they used to make fun of him and the family a little bit for it, because he would sometimes be aggressive with it. They like walk into a hospital like that. How it's supposed to be done. And that was clarified to me when I got older, so I never got in trouble myself for it. But that's how
how my mother grew up, and that's there's a lot more where that came from. But I actually have wonderful memories of going and visiting. And after he passed away at a relatively untimely age, I passed away in his young 60s. He had a bad heart, and frankly, he was fortunate to live. He gained a number of years. He had a quintuple bypass surgery at one point, and thank God he made it. To that point, but when he passed away and we were there with the family sitting shiva, I heard extraordinary stories from the local community and throughout, and it's really that inspiration to this day. My mother is extremely devoted to Chabad and has tremendous respect for Chabad. She's not personally, she's not in the Chabad community actively, but there's tremendous respect there. And her sister, Aunt Fagi, is Lubavitcher. They live in Crown Heights. They have a minion of boys in the home. 10 boys and 2 girls. That's Seawald.
Seawald? Seawald? Cars?
Seawald. The cars? Yeah, that's my uncle. Okay. If you ever see Seawald,
Samech Yud
Vavav Lamed. There's an I in there in Hebrew. You can actually go around, if you go around to New York City, you can see the Hebrew printed on the back of the most random.
My daughter worked for him for us.
Oh, there you go. Okay. You're welcome.
He did his books for us.
There, you can pay me back anytime. That's all good. But there's more where that came from. Happy to elaborate. But it really is it's a debt of gratitude, and it's quite profound. So I wanted to share that before jumping in. Okay, so I wanted to spend just a few minutes sharing a lecture. It's not word for word the lecture, or even a direct summary, but it is very much based on a lecture of Rav Soloveitchik, and it was printed up in a book entitled Man of Faith in the Modern World, Reflections of the Rav, which I have over here, volume 2. Perhaps some have seen it. It was put together by someone by the name of Rabbi Avram Beistin. Rabbi Avram Beistin was the director of the JSS program at Yeshiva University, which was essentially a mechina, or an introductory program for students who did not necessarily have yeshiva backgrounds and did not have high levels of Torah literacy. He was active there for many years, and he was a close student of Rav Soloveitchik, and it's written up here. I have a copy. I'm happy to share if anyone would like to see. It's just a written summary. It's not a word-for-word transcription, but it's a very nice write-up. So I wanted to elaborate a little bit and hew to the Rav's basic structure, and we're going to kind of piggyback on Hoshana Rabbah and look forward toward Simchas Torah as well. And ironically, I don't have too much brisker lamdos. You got much more involved in that than I did. I only regret not including Hasidisha sources here, but I'll do what I can do. But hopefully, we'll touch on some of some overlapping themes as well. The Rav makes the following observation. This really is the starting point for this particular shir. He says, when we take a look at the holiday of Sukkot, in particular, this practice of going around, this notion of encircling, right? And that's really the theme that I want to kind of zone in on for the next couple of minutes together. It says there are really three of these practices, phenomena that we find in the Jewish tradition. He says the first, as Rabbi Sherman mentioned, was to go back to the time of the temple, the time of the Beit HaMikdash. They would take the Arava and they would encircle the Mizbeach. And the height of that was certainly on Hoshana Rabbah. And that was the practice in the Beit HaMikdash, and that was one example. And what was at the center, as we said, the Mizbeach. So that's number one. Nowadays, of course, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, so what do we do over the course of the 7 days of Sukkot? So we take our Baminim and then the Arava specifically. For these purposes, the Rav wraps them up together. I guess he held like that side in the Chakira, right? And the Rav says, what do we do nowadays? We take the Baminim and we encircle, right, the Bima, and what, generally speaking, is located in the middle of the Bima? What do we have? We have the Sefer Torah. So first, in the Beis HaMikdash, we encircled... Right, we encircled the Mizbeach, and then subsequently, nowadays, over the course of the holiday of Sukkot, we go around the Sefer Torah on the Bima, and then we come to the holiday of Simchas Torah. And what is it that we do on Simchas Torah? Well, we go around the Bima, but what exactly is on the Bima? Right? So the Rav says, maybe he's, I don't know if he actually uses this language, but we can say, trick question, right? That's at least what we might say in Kohelet, right? It's a trick question, right? I was getting you guys all along. The Rav says, we encircle, yes, the Bima, but the Sifrei Torah are conspicuously absent, and instead, of course, are encircling along with us. So the Rav asks a very basic question, almost, but not quite a simple question, if you will. The Rav wants to know, what gives? Right? Why is it that first we circle something, and then later in history we circle something else, and it's only at the very end of Sukkot, on the day of Shmini Atzeres or Simchas Torah, that all of a sudden we start to go around absolutely nothing? And in particular, the Rav starts with the question, well, what exactly are we going around on Simchas Torah? And while in this year he does not point to this, I'm fairly sure that that I heard this another occasion in his name, and I saw it cited in the name of a number of outstanding Lithuanian halachic authorities who say that actually it's not that we are going around nothing, right? Rather, it is that we are going around something very specific, if invisible and not tangible, namely we are going around the Shechina. We are encircling the divine presence. And in fact, there are those, including the Vilna Gaon, who suggested that this idea emerges from, and the basis for this is from the Gemara at the very end of Tractate Tanit, where the Gemara teaches us in Source 1 that Amar Ula Bira'a, Amar Rabbi Elazar, so Ula of the city of Bira'a, Bira said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, Asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'asos Machula Tzadikim V'hu Yoshev V'neihem B'gan Eden V'cholechot V'echot Mara Be'etzba'o. So he says, in the future, at the end of days, all of the righteous individuals will first of all have a dance. They'll do a little jig, a little simcha tanz, but of a different sort. And he will be sitting among them in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. And what will every individual, what would every righteous individual do at that time? Each one, whatever this means, right? And obviously there's depth and profundity here. Each and every one of the righteous will point to God with his finger. Cites a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Shnemar v'amar b'yom ahu hinei Elokeinu zeh. This is our God. Kivinu lo v'yoshienu zeh. Hashem kivinu lo negvila v'nisvacha v'yishua. So as it were, this is the God. This has in evocations of a series of other midrashim which we might have encountered in the past. For example, the notion Moshe Rabbeinu is unclear. He doesn't know exactly what the new moon looks like. So the midrash says, that what does God say to him? It says, kazeh. Right, that you should see it looks like this, right? So God actually gave him an image, and there are other parallel kinds of metaphors that we find in the Midrashim, in Chazal, and so the Gemara has a very similar idea. So comes along the Rav and says, and this is the first major point that he made in this particular drasha, says we're not going around the Sifrei Torah, we're not going around the Bima, and in this case we're not going around nothing. On Simchas Torah we are imagining, we are reenacting, or is this the word? Pre-enacting? Can you pre-enact? How would you say that?
What? Catalyze.
Foreshadowing.
Catalyze. Foreshadow. Okay, there's the English. There you go. All right. Perhaps foreshadowing, anticipating the ultimate image and experience of the righteous at the end of days, which is, I think, itself a very beautiful and profound idea, but it provokes additional questions on the part of Rav Soloveitchik. And his first point is, well, what were we waiting for the whole time? He says, wait a second, you're telling me that for 7 days we've been going around the Mizbech, for 7 days we've been going around the Bima, right, or the Sefer Torah in hand, and now and only now we get to go around the Kadosh Baruch Hu? Where were we? Why couldn't we skip ahead? Why did we have to wait for so long? And here the Rav comes along and he says something that I think is quite brisker, or even Lithuanian, if you will. He says that in his opinion, the proper philosophy of halacha, or the philosophy of halacha, he claims, is that we do best if we don't skip steps. He says it's tricky to skip steps, and not only is it tricky to skip steps, but it's important in the halachic regimen and the halachic system to first observe in a way that is objective, and then to transition to something that is subjective. He says halacha is suspicious of spirituality that is not grounded and anchored in action. It needs to be built upon sort of a foundation of halachic observance. Of course, there's value to pure spirituality. We should strive for that. But if we can build a foundation of something that is more grounded, something that is more deeply anchored, says the Rav, that is really the idea ideal philosophy or the ideal way that the halacha and that Judaism wish to set forth for us. And he says, therefore, this progression, beginning with encircling a physical object, which represents and manifests this idea of something that's concrete, something that we can kind of pull ourselves down to here on earth with, that comes first, and then, and building on that, the ultimate aspiration is that we ought to come to a place where we recognize that in the end, when we went around the Mizbeach, when we went around the Sefer Torah, ultimately that was because what we were aiming for was to go around God himself, as it were, to really be connected. And the Rav adds to this, he says, you know, in my opinion, says Rav Soloveitchik, this goes to a core philosophy of Judaism. And he alludes here to one of his great works called Halachic Man, Isha Halacha. Anyone have any exposure to this? If people heard about this particular book, I highly recommend it. It's absolutely fascinating, although I have to confess, the first 20 pages of this book are pure philosophy. And I have to say, I read it when I was in college, and I had this huge dictionary next to me, and it was a little bit painful. It was quite rewarding. I went around the Sefer Torah and the Mizbeach too many times to count before I finally got to the essence of it. But I recommend those 20 pages. I also happen to recommend the next 90, which are not really of Jewish philosophy and actually quite accessible. I won't tell you whether or not to skip steps. But Halachic Man was originally written and published in 1945. The Rav is 41 years old, and this is based to a large degree of what he studies in his time in Berlin. In fact, he writes a number of works that are rooted in the philosophy that he studied, the Rav, at the University of Berlin, where he spent time with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and other greats as well. Nechama Leibovitch was there at the same time, others as well. There is an apocryphal story of the three of them having coffee together at a local coffee shop, and they asked Nechama Leibovitch actually about it later on. He says, she said, first of all, she was very, very humble. She said, there's no way I would have agreed to that. I would have felt completely out of place there, which is part of the reason that she would have been completely in her league to be joining with those individuals. But she also said, the truth is, though, even though I would never have done it and I have no memory of it happening, it sounds great. That was her comment about the coffee shop. So anyhow, so the Rav studies, he does less the study of coffee and more the study of philosophy, and he gets involved in that, and he comes to this notion where he develops, based on those ideas, a very powerful philosophy of Judaism. And the Rav says that essentially in Judaism, the goal is not to escape this world, but rather to enhance and to sanctify this world. That the goal of all of our halachic practices, of our entire life, whether it be an observance or really everything that we do in the spirit of b'chol derechecha da'ehu, knowing God in every element of our existence, says the Rav, really ultimately the purpose is to take the divine blueprint and to manifest, to actualize it here on earth. When halachic man, and he actually invents this type, because before I read the book, I had not yet heard of a halachic man, right? That was a new type for me, and the Rav often worked in these typologies. And the Rav says that's what the halachic man does. So it gets a little bit, you know, sort of out-of-body experience at times, sometimes reading it, because, for example, the Rav says, halachic man goes outside and sees a telephone wire. What does halachic man see? Right? Let's see, right? An Eruv. Right? And he goes and he sees the sun setting on Yom Kippur. What does halachic man see? He says, that is the halachic, right? He says, you can go a little far, right? The Rav says, that is the halachic element that ensures the sunset of Yom Kippur has the power to purify the Jewish people. He says, that's the halachic sunset. So almost sometimes goes to an extreme to the point that, you know, leave aside the natural beauty of it, but let's focus on sort of the halachic significance. There's a tension there. Nonetheless, the Rav's larger point, though, is, I think, a very critical one, I think, goes to this philosophy. And the Rav invokes that in this context as well. The Rav says, since our goal is not to escape this world, but rather to uplift and to inspire and to sanctify this world with this objective halachic vision, that of the halachic man, therefore we start. It's critical that we start with the concrete. We start with the Sefer Torah, because that represents our ultimate goal. When we're circling God, our goal is not to leave this world, but to take the Sefer Torah, to have that concrete vision with us as we are participating in this world. So that's really very much the vision of Halachic Man, and that's what he sees, I think, very beautifully in this image. But then the Rav has one more question. The Rav says, so we have this beautiful idea on Simchas Torah. What we're doing is we're going around the Shechina itself. And by the way, we don't have this practice at Kohelet. I don't know what the minhag is at Chabad. But there were some poskim who said, based on this idea that the Shechina is at the Bima, that you should not touch the Bima during the Hakafos on Simchas Torah. Okay, I was actually once at a shul. Someone, a kid, climbed up on top. You know what I'm talking about. Climbed up on top. Little kid climbed up on top of the bima and started yelling. And someone said, "No, it's against the halacha. It's the shrinas in the middle, etc." So, right? I mean, it's interesting. I even once saw someone banging. Okay, I'll confess. I bang on Simchas Torah. I don't hold from this particular chumrah. But I remember in one shul, one year in Simchas Torah, some sort of banging on the bima just to get everyone lebedik and get everyone into everything. I said, no. That's the Mashchina, you can't do that. So again, even if we don't necessarily practice this or implement it in practice, I think there's a very powerful idea, and there's a nafgamina, Rabbi Sherman. There's a nafgamina, there's a practical application to this idea as well. Good, I was Yosei. I hope I got my It's good to make sure it's legitimate. Good, so then the Rav asks one final question. The Rav says, okay, I understand why we wait. He says, but what exactly is the symbolism of this circle? Why a circle? Says we could, right? So maybe it's hard to dance in a square. I know that would be a little bit of a challenge. Try it at home, see what happens. But you know, it seems presumably, right? It's a machol. Machol presumably is some sort of circular, right? Circular imagery, and they all seem to be equidistant. From what you can see, it sounds like they're all in this circle. They're all dancing, and each one's pointing. There's no clear evidence, but it kind of sounds like they're all kind of on the same wavelength, and as it were, whatever it means, pointing to the Shechina at the end of days. And that's again what we anticipate on Simchas Torah. Well, what's the significance of this circle? So the Rav offers three explanations. I'll say the first very briefly, and then I'll just slightly elaborate the latter two. So the first one the Rav develops is another one of his core ideas. He says all of religious life is to come close, but not too close. Right, almost as if the divine spirit is almost like a fire. Right, we're drawn to its warmth. But the danger is, at the same time, if we come too close to the Shechina, what happens? Right? We might get burned. So the Rav says all of life is about this process of advance in retreat, advance in retreat. And it brings a metaphor. He actually writes an article entitled Catharsis. And catharsis is about this motif. And he actually, interestingly enough, he brings the example of Yaakov wrestling with the angel as the paradigm for this idea. The Rav says in this article, Catharsis, he says, what was Yaakov thinking? You ever wonder about this, right? He's wrestling with the angel, right? What happens? Right? He gets a little bit injured. And nonetheless, the sense is that he's on the brink of victory. And then the angel says, oh, well, it's daybreak. Sorry, I'm done. Right, so if you were, it's hard to imagine. I'll say for myself, if I were in a wrestling match, okay, fine. Have some fun with this. Right, if I were really intent on winning, right, if it were really a competition, right, when I was back in TBC, right, high school wrestling was all the rage. So that says the memory that it evokes for me. So right, if someone's in a wrestling competition and you're on the cusp of victory, and then all of a sudden your combatant says, right, your competitor says, you know what, I'm out, I'm done. Right, what would a competitor would? Right, press for victory. Otherwise, why having this whole wrestling match in the first place? The whole story seems a little bit odd. Why did Yaakov just all of a sudden stop right at the moment that he was about to win his wrestling match? And the Rav says, this is not just a wrestling match. And this is not even just representative of the eternal wrestling match that the Midrash identifies, until the end of days at least, between the Jews and our enemies, but this is actually something more profound than even that. Rather, this is really about the religious experience. Yaakov was exemplifying for us the notion that religious experience, yes, is about advance, yes, is about achievement, about accomplishing, it's about victory, it's It's about building wonderful buildings and wonderful things and achieving great accomplishments. But at the same time, ultimately, it's also about recognizing our limitations, our distance, the advance and the retreat. Yaakov says, I'm done with my wrestling match. And that is an embodiment of the entirety of Avodas Hashem, of our relationship with God. And he says, that's what this circle exemplifies. We're close. We're right there and we can see God, but we don't actually touch God, because we can enjoy that relationship. But as soon as we come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we are reminded of our limitations. And so it's back and forth, back and forth. Ratzo v'shov, would that be the right terminology, right? To advance and to retreat. I wonder if this is something that he got from his chassidus, from those exposures. Ratzo v'shov is a, you can probably explain it better than I can.
It's based on a verse in Yeshayahu, or Yechezkel, about the angels running and retreating from Hashem. And it's similar to exactly what you're saying. And a person's on Avodas Hashem, there's an Ava, a love for Hashem, that you want to get close and close and close. There's also a Yira, and being in awe of Hashem, which is the idea of distance. We're always playing off that tension and coming close and coming retreating.
Very, very nice. And if anyone's interested, if you take a look at source number 2, there's a beautiful passage in the Rambam where he talks about exactly this dialectic, this back and forth between Ava and Yira, and I commend it quite highly to your attention. Feel free. So that's the Rav's first explanation. The second one I thought was perhaps even more striking, if it were possible. And what the Rav theorizes is as follows. He says, you know, in the circle, he says, everyone is equidistant to the center. Everyone is just as far and just as close to, far from and close to, the middle. And he says the second symbol of the dancing of Simchas Torah is the fundamental, and this, I think, plays off some of the themes that Rabbi Sherman was talking about as well, the fundamental equality of every single Jew. That on a certain very profound level, not that there are no levels, no distinctions, but there is a very basic and fundamental way in which, as represented at the end of days, but even anticipated now in Simchas Torah, that sense of connection, that sense of equality, that sense that we are all within sort of equal reach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Rav cites some very beautiful texts, and I saw as soon as you had Rabbi Sherman on your text, I thought it was appropriate that I had source 4, the classic Midrash. I don't think you could give a share on Sukkot with that, including this. I don't know if it's such a raya. Anyone? Okay, what particular orientation? But certainly the idea that all the Jews are represented in the Arba Amina, the Rav goes further. He says, you know, the Torah, there's a notion of the Torah scholars. Certainly we all aspire to Torah scholarship. That's a critical piece. Some people are going to simply attain higher levels in Torah study, in Torah understanding, and that's a good thing, and that's something we revere, and that's something we respect highly in our tradition. And yet at the same time, he says, there's a democratic streak that runs through the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And this is the idea of the Keser Torah, the Rav says. And that's source number 3, that B'shlosha Ksarim Nichteru Yisrael, based on Gemara Yoma, the Rambam says very beautifully that the Jewish people were endowed with 3 crowns. And says the Rambam, the first 2, namely that of priesthood and that of kingship, that of monarchy, those are only given to certain individuals. You have to be born a Kohen. You have to earn the right to the crown. Nonetheless, the Rambam says, Keser Torah Hare Munach V'Omer Mucham L'Chol Yisrael, that's something that is available to everyone, and that's something. Kol mi sheyirtze yavo v'yitol. Anyone who wants it can come and can take it. A very beautiful idea from the Rav in this regard. And I'm running late on time, so I'm going to very briefly share the other 2 pieces of this, and then one concluding thought, and then turn to the open it up for more discussion. But if you take a look at the next slide, I wanted to share 2 very quick vortlach based on this, and I'll say them in brief. The first one comes from Dr. Norman Lamb. Dr. Norman Lamb is the past president of Yeshiva University, the 3rd president. We're now up to number 5. And Dr. Lamb happens to be, those many might know, is also my wife's grandfather, so we have a very rich personal connection. When Tov and I were dating, we had the opportunity to go and to learn. We learned a little Chassidus, actually, with Dr. Lamb. And the truth is that in addition to the Chabad roots, the connection to Chassidus also came partly for me through the relation with Rabbi Lamb. Rabbi Lamb extremely interested in and actually compiled an entire book on Chassidut with, I think, 19 chapters on different aspects of Hasidic thought, including many passages from the Tanya. We actually learned some of the Tanya together. So that was, this brings back tremendous memories for me. And he said an unbelievable word that connects to this idea of equality. He says, you know, we say something very funny when we bench Rosh Chodesh on Shabbos. We say, Misha'asa nisim lavosinu, v'ga'alasam yavdos l'cheiros. We say that the one who redeemed our forefathers, etc. V'yugalasam mekar v'kabitz nidachinu mi'abakan fosaretz. God should gather us, chaverim kol Yisrael. If we were in the English class, this is a dictionary, right? Classic case of a non sequitur. What is going on over here? Really? Chaverim kol Yisrael, a beautiful idea. What does it have to do with anything? So say, okay, Yimos HaMashiach, etc., beautiful. There are many themes in Yimos HaMashiach. Why specifically this one? What's going on? The Rav says something, Dr. Lam says something very beautiful. He said, Chaverim also is a technical term. It says, at the time of the Gemara, there were actually tremendous tensions between two social groups in the Jewish community. One was called the Chaverim, the other one were called the Amei Haaretz. The Chaverim were people who were very meticulous in areas of halacha, specifically with regard to tithes. The tithes in particular, and the Amei Haaretz were the ones that you couldn't necessarily trust. And if you take a look, this Gemara Masechta, and there are tremendous tensions that really riveted the community, at least at certain points during Talmudic history. It was really very difficult between them. So Dr. Lam says, Chaverim kol Yisrael doesn't just mean we're all going to be friends. It means something else. It means the class divisions among the Jewish people that sought to tear us apart during the age of the Gemara, those will be healed during the period of Mashiach. Chaverim kol Yisrael, every Jew will be a chaver. There won't be any social classes because there won't be religious separations. There won't be social distinctions among the Jews in the community. Chaverim kol Yisrael, and Dr. Lam says, that is an essential part of the vision of Yimos HaMashiach. And I think it goes back to the Gemara in Tanis, because everyone's pointing in Kadosh Baruch Hu, and they're in that circle, and they're all feeling that sense of connection, just like in the Arba Minim. So I think this idea of Chaverim Kol Yisrael fits in quite nicely. Source 6, I'm not going to have really time for, but I'll point out very briefly, there's a beautiful idea around Tu B'Av. Tu B'Av is, the Gemara says, one of the two most joyous holidays of the year. It's a very strange holiday. They would go out, they would have a jig, right, the machal, right, the circle, what's going on over there, how does it connect? But I think if you take a look, that whole story is really not just about a circle, and it's not just about, so those who are familiar, around setting up, or dating, and the courtship, and so on and so forth, because that was how we would perform shiduchim. But more than that, it was actually an opportunity for the wealthy young ladies to ensure that those who were impoverished had what to wear as well, and that there were no social distinctions whatsoever. They would give them the same colored clothing, the same quality clothing. They would all be able to go and participate as full equals. And I think the Gemara juxtaposes these intentionally to say, yeah, that's the machalat tzaddikim. It's the same idea of the breaking down of those boundaries of the true equality among all members of the Jewish people. That's the messianic vision, but more than that, that's something we should attempt to actualize in our world today. And then, if we have these two themes, the first one is the idea of advance and retreat, says the Rav. That's the idea of the circle, not too close, not too far. Number two, the idea that everyone is equidistant. Finally, he points out that it also, a circle is the opposite of a finite line. Right? In other words, right? If we have not a line, right? Guys, remind me, right? Math people. Sam, remind me. It's in a line. It's a line segment, right? Did I get that right? What? It comes to. It has to stop. If it's a line, it goes on forever. If it's a line segment, so I don't want to. I want to misspeak in front of a math person. What? What? Right. So a circle is similar to a line. Okay, I think I got this right. I have your Kushpanka. Thank you very much. The idea of it's the opposite of a line segment. It's similar to a line in that it never ends. It's not just equidistant, but the circle goes on forever. And the idea is that the eternal joy of the tzaddikim and the joy that we anticipate on Simchas Torah is one that will ultimately be eternal. We have complete joy, pure joy. And I quoted not something from the Rav, but something from the Ramar of Moshe Isserles, the great halachic codifier. And he points to this Gemara and he says, Kia Eagle, in lo rosh v'sof. It's not just that there's no beginning and ends, or everyone's equidistant, but it goes on forever. And even quotes the Chachmei HaEmes. I was close there, which is an allusion to Kabbalah, to the Kabbalistic tradition here as well. So I think it really pulls it all together for the Rav. There are really these three themes. You have the idea of the advance and retreat, equidistance, and ultimately that this is the pure eternal joy. And it's my bracha to us all that over the course of this coming Simchas Torah, we bring right here down on earth, right here, right now, not just waiting for the end of days, but already actualize this halachic man in the world right now, that sense of pure simcha, of joy, of going around the Eivishter, right? Going around the Eivishter, and everyone, may we all merit to that, and l'chaim in the water. Okay, so at this point, feel free to ask any questions on my presentation, Rabbi Sherman's presentation, but more broadly. This is an opportunity for us to talk a little bit more about the relationship between these traditions, and this is an open conversation, so you can all take this wherever you would like, please. I'm going to run. Yeah, okay, fine. Okay. Good. Anyone wants to stay for Shirayim is welcome to stay. Take for the way.
But how come you're